Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Jason Guberman, founder of Diarna, the Geo Museum of North African and Middle Eastern Jewish Life. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. It's hard to believe, but it's already November in this unfortunate 2020 year. The presidential, senatorial, and congressional elections will complete their in-person voting in a couple of days, and I, for one, will be greatly relieved not to have to watch any more political ads on television, YouTube, Facebook, or hearing them on the radio. It's not as though most have been positively driven, either. I guess that three-quarters of them or more have been negative political ads, harshly criticizing opposition candidates with statements and images that combine half-truths, insinuations, and outright lies in an attempt to sway voters. It's not as though this is a brand new concept in American elections or any elections, but it does seem to be growing worse in every election cycle. Still, we can't pretend it's something novel. In the presidential election of 1800, then-President John Adams was pilloried as a tyrant and tool of Great Britain by Thomas Jefferson supporters. In 1828, President John Quincy Adams accused Andrew Jackson's wife Rachel of being a bigamist, or at least his people did, which had grains of truth but broke her heart and, according to Jackson, killed her before he could take office. Abraham Lincoln was caricatured as the original gorilla for his gangly appearance. For many years after the Civil War, every Democratic Party candidate for office heard about the dead in that terrible conflict, while every Republican candidate at some point would wave the bloody shirt, claiming that all Democrats were Confederates and traitors. In 1884, Grover Cleveland's campaign for president was nearly upended by the revelation that he had fathered a child out of wedlock. He was himself a bachelor, and Republicans chanted at him, "Ma, ma, where's my pa? He's gone to the White House, ha, ha, ha." Quite likely the greatest presidential sloganeering ever. More recently, Lyndon Johnson ran the famous Daisy ad, at least his campaign did, showing a 3-year-old girl counting off petals on a daisy, followed by the countdown and explosion of a nuclear bomb going off. And while it aired only once, it devastated Barry Goldwater's right-wing campaign. Goldwater himself was never mentioned in that ad, by the way, not even his famous dictum that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. You were just supposed to figure it out, and people did. In recent years, negative attack ads have become more specific and much more ubiquitous. Everybody running for office is a crook, has evil business connections, or is corrupt. And even anti-Semitic ads implying Jewish control of the world economy or of a particular candidate. Can you remember the Trump ads against Hillary Clinton 4 years ago showing photos of her linked to an international banking conspiracy and global political establishment, and then showing photos of George Soros, Janet Yellen, and Lloyd Blankfein, all Jewish, all financial leaders? Well, those attacks are apparently legal and fair game. And while I'd wager more negative ads are coming from Republican campaigns this time around, there have been plenty of anti-president and anti-Republican ads, too. I guess our current leaders believe you can't win if you don't get into the gutter. It also seems to get worse every single electoral cycle. Robo-phone calls coming in at every hour. Robo-texts from changing phone numbers show up several times a day. All those emails and ads on social media and online media. A mailbox full of political ads, mostly negative. At times like these, I'd like to return to the Jewish standards associated with ethical speech, the laws of Lashon Hara. They come originally from the Torah, in which the clear statement is, "Lo telech rachil b'amecha," do not become a slanderer among your people. and it's echoed and then vastly amplified in the Talmud, particularly in the later works of Musar, the teachings of Jewish morality and self-correction. According to the greatest authority on the ethics of speech, the Chofetz Chaim, there are 31 different rules limiting harsh and defamatory speech derived from the Torah. These go so far as to stipulate that even telling the truth in a hurtful way is prohibited, while lying to damage others is a particularly evil sin that no Jew should ever practice. Gossip is damaging, and according to the Talmud, it kills three people: the one who tells the gossip, the one who listens to the gossip, and the one about whom the gossip is said. I like the Rotary Club's standard of speech, the four-way test, which I learned when I was in Rotary Club years ago. It's always impressed me as derived from the same thoughtful moral approach as Judaism's understanding of the ethics of speech and its doctrines on Lashon Hara and Motzi Shem Ra. Here's the Rotary Club four-way test for how to speak, which would certainly also apply to political ads. 1. Is it the truth? 2. Is it fair to all concerned? 3. Will it build goodwill and better friendships? And 4. Will it be beneficial to all concerned? I do not think the vast majority of the ads we've been subjected to this election season could qualify under those standards, or certainly not under Jewish standards. May they, well, all of us, learn that these standards should apply by the time of the next electoral cycle. To play us in this morning on a similar theme, here's a lovely setting of Mihaish from Psalm 34. It says, "Who is the one who delights in life, the one who guards his or her tongue from speaking evil?" From singer Ronit Ophir, Rabbi Baruch Chait's beautiful composition.
Metzor leshon chamera usfatecha midaber mirma sur merab aseto bakesh shalom merot feru
Mihaish, who is the one who has a good life, the one who keeps far from evil speech, something all of our American candidates could learn from Jewish tradition. When we return in a moment here on Two Jewish, our guest, Jason Guberman, the founder of Diarna, the Geomuseum of North African and Middle Eastern Jewish Life, will tell us what motivated him to create this amazing online version of some of the great synagogues and Jewish communities of the Sephardic and Middle Eastern world, some of which no longer exist, and just how he did it. Find out when we return in a moment here on Two Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson in the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is located at 2270 West Dinah Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our very own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. In these days of coronavirus Tsoras, a small group can join us in person Friday night and or Saturday morning. Just email me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHATucson.org. Or you can join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 and Saturday morning services at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. Our services will be there with full music by virtual experience weekly, as well as our in-person, masked, and socially careful attendees. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom, and some are in blended format as well. Access them through our website or email me at BeitSimchaTucson.org. Many of those classes, as well as our wonderful religious school, have reopened in blended formats, limited but blended formats, both live and on Zoom. Synagogues at 2270 West Dinah Road, west of La Cholla on the north side, in our own building. You can email me for more information, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. For more information, go to our website. You can attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses on Zoom, and of course our services on Facebook, BEITSIMCHATucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community and the fastest growing one in all of southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Jewish Jason Guberman, who is the creator of a fantastic program called Diarna, which has almost reinvented and preserved some remarkable synagogues throughout the Dharma Greb, some of which no longer exist in virtual format now, and has other hats or yarmulkes he wears too. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you so much.
Can you tell us about the origin of Diarna?
So Diarna began in the spring and summer of 2008. I was a student at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut.
Nice Jewish school, by the way, Sacred Heart.
Exactly, a nice Jewish school, and I was actually the first Jewish class president. And to really throw people for a loop, I was also a fellow of a Muslim civil rights organization and even organized a human rights conference and /rock concert for Iranian dissidents.
Fantastic. So you were at Sacred Heart.
I was at Sacred Heart, and I was doing Middle East Studies before they even had a Middle East Studies program. And I had this interest in Jews in the Middle East and North Africa. I realized that there was a gaping gap in the historiography when it came to this subject. And then amidst that backdrop, a friend contacted me. He had just gotten back from Morocco. His wife has roots in southern Morocco. And he was very concerned, as you know, 3, 4, 5 decades removed from Jewish life, how his daughter was going to connect with her Jewish history in Morocco. And I had this crazy network of friends from the Middle East civil rights work I was doing. I very quickly connected with the other co-founder of Diarna, Professor Fran Molino from Wellesley College, head of Jewish studies at Wellesley. And we had this inkling of this technology called Google Earth, which would enable us to digitally document the sites and put connect sites and stories. And so that's how we got started.
It's an extraordinary endeavor. The goal was to capture these remarkable synagogues all through North Africa and the Middle East, many of which are endangered. That's correct?
Exactly. So synagogues, cemeteries, schools, shrines, any structure of significance to the Jewish community, even public places where events relevant to Jewish history happen.
And in documenting them, I'm sure you'll tell some of those stories, but people actually have to go in and take the video, right?
So we've had over, at this point, 60 expeditions to the region. We also work very closely with young Arabs, Berbers, Kurds, and other people of good conscience on the ground who are passionate about preserving this history, especially in places where it's not possible to send a team from America.
We will talk much more with our guest this morning, Jason Guberman, about Diarna and its remarkable chronicling of Jewish synagogues throughout the Middle East and North Africa. We'll return in a moment, and hear some risky stories along the way, too, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at tojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's tojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website, tojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store. It's a very popular podcast, over 100,000 downloads so far. Top 10 Jewish show in North America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, we joked on the air, once a while back, about the fact that there's never any real population of Jews in Armenia, because the Armenians were basically the Jews of the area anyway. The Armenians were so similar to Jews.
Right.
There is a terrible conflict going on now in Nagorno-Karabakh between Armenia and Azerbaijan, which threatens to envelop not only the whole region, but maybe the whole world. I think you are uniquely qualified to talk about that area.
Yeah, mostly because at the time when I opened the first U.S. embassy in post-Soviet Armenia, this was a hot shooting war. And we thought by 1994 that we had put it to rest forever through a high-level negotiating group called the Minsk Group, through the efforts of the OSCE, et cetera, et cetera. But its roots are deep, and apparently we were wrong. And the reason it poses such a great risk today is that it risks enveloping, at the very least, Russia and Turkey, who are already involved. Turkey is a NATO ally. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which is what NATO is an acronym for, was created by something called the North Atlantic Treaty, which we signed in the late 40s, and which basically kept the peace in Europe for at least 50 years. Article 5 of that treaty obliges every signatory to treat an attack on another signatory as an attack on its own territory, and to respond in kind. So, right now what's going on in the South Caucasus is that the Turkish client state of Azerbaijan, which is an oil-producing state, a Muslim-majority country where the language is almost indistinguishable from Turkish, the alphabet is different, and which has a long history of being hospitable to Jews, that country has attacked this small Armenian enclave that Stalin put inside the borders of Azerbaijan. It's called Nagorno-Karabakh in Russian and Artsakh in Armenian. And they're killing civilians and whatever. They're using weapons that they bought from Israel, which had the unfortunate consequence of the newly appointed Armenian ambassador to Israel was recalled back to Yerevan because they see Israel as enabling the Azerbaijanis. But more importantly, the Turks are actually involved in the fighting. And Azerbaijan is clearly a client state of Turkey. Russia has always been a sort of godfather to Armenia because Armenia is a little Christian enclave in the heart of the Muslim world. I mean, its neighbors are Iran, Azerbaijan, Turkey, and Georgia. So our leadership has basically two choices, which is either honor our treaty commitments under Article 5 and respond to attacks on Turkey as if they were attacks on us, which means getting into a war with Russia, or abrogating the treaty and risking the dissolution of NATO, just its total destruction and disappearance because we didn't honor a key commitment. So it's almost a no-win situation. If we still had a functioning State Department with a depth of knowledge and experience, we could try some behind-the-scenes negotiations and look for a peaceful solution. But in the current state of affairs, particularly given the current nature of the State Department, that seems highly unlikely.
Really, it could be quite tragic. And NATO has been an incredible stabilizing force for the world.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish Humor, Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Mort sits down at a table in his local deli and orders a pastrami sandwich. 5 minutes later, the waiter arrives with his sandwich, but Mort can't help noticing the waiter is holding the sandwich down on the plate with his bare thumb. "I'm not meshuggah, you know," says Mort. "You don't think I'm accepting that sandwich with your thumb all over it?" The waiter says, "Well, I'm sure you don't want it to fall on the floor again." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And maybe don't eat in any delis right now anyway. And now a word of Torah. What do you think is the essential Jewish characteristic? Is it the ability to survive, as we have done for, 3,800 years since the days of Abraham and Sarah? Is it the enjoyment of food, without which no event seems really Jewish? Is it our profound and ancient commitment to learning that's our most unique quality? Or is it the willingness to argue that makes us truly Jewish? You know the stereotype. You have two Jews, you have three opinions. We have developed over the millennia a remarkable talent for disagreement, and that is reflected in everything from our taste in synagogues and Jewish food to our Talmudic literature. What is the Talmud, after all, but a very, very long, extended argument? You may not realize that this tendency to argue is also quite ancient, dating back to the very first Jew, Abraham. In this week's Torah portion of Vayera, he teaches us something central through the medium of argument. In our Torah portion last week, Lech Lecha, Abraham was called by God to leave his homeland and journey to an unknown land. Atypically, for all the Jews who followed him, he did so unquestioningly, taking a great leap of faith into a new and strange place, trusting God to bring him to his destiny without questioning. But that's not the whole story. And in this week's portion of Vayera, things are different. This portion includes the remarkable tale of the impending destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, a traumatic decision by God to eradicate evil from the world, or at least try. In one of the great scenes in all of biblical history, God tells Abraham of his plans to destroy those wicked cities, which were sort of the Las Vegas and Atlantic City of the ancient world. Anyway, instead of nodding politely and accepting God's decision, Abraham nobly steps forward and protests. He does so with another one of the great Jewish qualities, chutzpah. What if there are righteous people in Sodom, 50 righteous? Would God destroy the city then, Abraham asks? Wouldn't that be immoral, for the judge of all the world to act unjustly? Hashofet kol haaretz lo ya'aseh mishpat? God agrees with Abraham's objection, but the noble Abraham keeps arguing. What if there are 45 righteous? 40? 30? Perhaps God wouldn't destroy Sodom for the sake of 20 righteous people. 10, a bare minimum. A minion. So God agrees that even 10 would be enough to save the cities. Of course, there aren't 10 who are righteous in Sodom. I mean, for a minion, don't go to Sodom. And the flesh pots of evil are marked for destruction. But it is Abraham's courageous defense of what might just turn out to be a righteous remnant that stands out. For this is the essential way all Jews ever since have interacted with God. We question and struggle and test God, always seeking greater justice in the world. We argue with God and become holier and better people through that process. Pirkei Avot, the great ethical tractate of the Mishnah, tells us that kol machloket l'shem shamayim, every argument for the sake of heaven will yield lasting benefit. That is, if we argue as Abraham did, for the sake of justice, holding even God to a higher standard than we are being the best Jews we possibly can be, and thus the best human beings we can be. When we argue against immorality in the world, or against the environmental destruction of our planet, or in favor of the rights of the downtrodden, the immigrants, the unemployed, the medically uninsured, the racial minorities, the homeless, we continue what Abraham began in this week's portion. These are machlokot l'shem shamayim, arguments truly for the sake of heaven. When we make these kinds of sacred arguments, not ones about our own ego, well, then our lives can, like Abraham's, bring great blessing. And then, as the Torah tells us, we too will be a blessing to all the families of the earth. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Jason Guberman, explains just how his team has managed to visually map some of the most endangered synagogues and Jewish communities in the world, including some in Syria, Iraq, and other war zones. Find out how you can view these amazing places virtually when we return in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Jeremy Corbyn was suspended from Britain's Labour Party after he disputed a report released last week that found that the party under his leadership was responsible for unlawful acts of harassment and discrimination against Jews. The report on Corbyn was published by the Equality and Human Rights Commission, the British government's watchdog on racism. It said that Labour under Corbyn, who led the party from 2015 to earlier this year, 2020, failed to address and resolve anti-Semitic behavior in its ranks. Among its recommendations, which are legally binding, was that Labour must live up to its commitment to be a political party with zero tolerance of anti-Semitism and give anti-racism training to its staff and members. In a reaction to the report, Jeremy Corbyn said that the scale of the problem has been dramatically overstated for political reasons. For that statement, and his failure to retract his words, he was suspended from the party, a spokesperson for Labour said. His title as party whip or speaker was also suspended. The decision to suspend Corbyn came from his centrist successor, Keir Starmer. Corbyn said his suspension was political and vowed to strongly contest it. The report, the most exhaustive and significant one published to date about Labour's anti-Semitism problem, was started in May of 2019. This is the first time the government commission has had to focus on a mainstream political party in Britain. Our investigation found that the Labour Party breached the Equality Act of 2010 by committing unlawful harassment through the acts of its agents in two of the complaints that we investigated, said the report, based on hundreds of testimonies and cases. There have been serious failings in leadership and an inadequate process for handling anti-Semitism complaints across the Labour Party, and we have identified multiple failures in the systems it uses to resolve them. The report is a significant development in the ongoing internal struggle within the Labour Party between Corbyn loyalists and more centrist allies of Starmer, who was elected in April. This was not the first report of its kind. In 2016, an interparliamentary review produced a damning report on Corbyn, who, among other actions, praised a mural of Jewish bankers playing Monopoly on the backs of black men, placed a wreath on a monument commemorating Palestinian terrorists, and endorsed a blanket boycott of Israel. Under his watch, British Labour members made anti-Semitic statements publicly and online. In response for criticizing Corbyn and his handling of the situation, some of the party's more centrist members were inundated with online abuse. Jewish Labour members, such as Luciana Berger and Louise Ellman, were taunted with anti-Semitic comments on social media. By 2019, about 50 Labour lawmakers had either resigned their posts or quit the party entirely to protest Corbyn's leadership, or lack of it. Corbyn had vowed to kick out anyone caught making anti-Semitic statements, and he did have some members expelled, but many others were not, including former London Mayor Ken Livingstone, who has repeatedly said publicly that Adolf Hitler was in cahoots with Zionists.
There's power in a factory, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker. But it all amounts to nothing if together we don't stand. There is power in a union. Now the lessons of the past were all learned with workers' blood. The spikes of the bosses we must fight for. Farmlands to trenches full of mud. War's always been the boss's wiser. The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leather workers unite. With our brothers and our sisters in many far off lands. There is power in a union.
Current Labour leader Starmer, a centrist, has apologized to British Jews for the growth of anti-Semitic sentiment in the party's ranks under his predecessor, calling it a stain, and vowing to demonstrate a change of leadership to restore the trust of the Jewish community. He called the report's release a day of shame for the Labour Party and promised to implement its recommendations as soon as possible in the new year. The findings of the report provide the most exhaustive verdict to date on Corbyn's legacy, plays a role in the internal power struggle being waged within Labour now between Keir Starmer and his allies and the supporters of Jeremy Corbyn, who are still in the party. Jonathan Sacerdoti, a founding trustee of the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, said, "Corbyn is gone, but the problem of Labour anti-Semitism is not." Labour's membership and overall makeup changed during Corbyn's tenure. Long the country's center-left mainstay and a political home for most British Jews, the party swerved much farther to the left. Labour's ranks swelled with members who favor more left-wing policies. Many of them believe that Jews are societal oppressors. The Board of Deputies of British Jews addressed this in their reaction to the report. Corbyn will rightly be blamed for what he has done to Jews and Labour, but the truth is more disturbing, as he was little more than a figurehead for old and new anti-Jewish attitudes. All of this was enabled by those who deliberately turned a blind eye, said their response. Marie van der Zijl, the board's president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews, still welcomed Corbyn's suspension. His shameless comments today show that he remains part of the problem and is an obstruction to the resolution of the issue, she wrote. Even though Corbyn and his cronies no longer run Labour, they are still a force to be reckoned with inside of Labour. Starmer, who inherited a polarized movement and an electoral low point, 202 seats out of 650 in the House of Commons, has had to calculate carefully how to keep an uneasy balance of power. Starmer, a 57-year-old former prosecutor who is married to a Jewish woman, has had every move highly scrutinized by the Jewish community. He has promoted multiple lawmakers with strained relationships with the Jewish community to party leadership, including Afzal Khan, an MP who in 2015 shared a video on Facebook with captions about the Israel-British-Swiss Rothschilds crime syndicate and mass-murdering Rothschild's Israeli mafia criminal liars. Khan later apologized, but then reportedly claimed the video was not anti-Semitic. In June, Starmer demoted a key Corbyn ally from her post for praising and retweeting an article that falsely claimed Israeli Secret Services trained U.S. police in knee chokeholds of the kind that killed George Floyd. Well, suspending Jeremy Corbyn's a good start. Now Labor has to clean house of anti-Semites totally and show that anti-Semitic behavior is not going to be tolerated in its ranks. And in New York, a leader of the Satmar Hasidic sect denounced protests earlier this month where local Orthodox Jews, ultra-Orthodox Jews, voiced their anger at lockdown measures targeting their neighborhoods. Rabbi Aaron Teitelbaum, leader of a faction of the Satmar Hasidic community based in Kiryas Yoel, a Hasidic enclave in New York's Orange County, denounced the protests at an event in Borough Park, the Brooklyn neighborhood where the protests themselves took place. "None of you should be seen at these protests," Teitelbaum told the crowd. "Praise to the person who doesn't follow in the ways of evil." The protests took place over two nights in October in response to new restrictions placed on ultra-Orthodox neighborhoods to curb rising COVID-19 test positivity rates among the Haredim. Violence broke out at both protests, masks were burned in the streets, and journalists were chased and surrounded by mobs. Heshi Tischler, a local radio host, ex-convict, and city council hopeful, was arrested after he led a mob surrounding a reporter and member of the Hasidic community at one of the protests. "It's good to hear Rabbi Teitelbaum, a prominent Hasid, prioritizing pikuach nefesh, saving lives during this pandemic, instead of mindlessly asserting some theatrical religious freedom that not only gets people sick, but kills some, and has made some ultra-Orthodox communities into super-spreader locations for COVID-19." And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Jason Guberman is the creator of Diarna, this remarkable project that has chronicled in virtual format a wide variety of extraordinary synagogues throughout what was called the Dar Maghreb, North Africa, but also throughout the Middle East. He is also, as I mentioned earlier, he has other yarmulkes. The other yarmulke is the executive director of the American Sephardi Federation. We'll talk about that a little bit too. When you started Diarna, like how did it begin? Did you travel to the Middle East? What did you do?
So it really started with my network of friends from the Middle East civil rights work that I had been doing, reaching out to them, people who got really passionate about this Jewish history. My favorite recruitment story is through my bubby, my grandmother of blessed memory, who knew this Egyptian family that was down the street from us in Stratford, Connecticut. And she went in, she told Shama about what I was doing and thought she might be helpful to the project. Shama said, "Absolutely, I would love to. You just, Jason needs to get my mother's approval." And I wasn't sure what to expect, but I went, I spoke to her mother. Her mother didn't speak much English, so Shama was translating for us. And at the end of it, her mother put up her thumb. I said Shukran Ali, my one word in Egyptian Arabic,
yep.
From that point on...
Sorry, Shukran Ali, and that said that, you know, thank you very much, that's it.
Yes, exactly. So so she ended up working on the project and helping us document sites, including in Damanhor, the shrine to the Baba Saleh's grandfather, the Abri Yaakov, which even growing up in rural Egypt, you know, she had no idea that there was this Jewish history all around her.
So once you'd begun, and using Google Earth, which allows you to post all this stuff, some of these synagogues, of course, are still standing. You can go visit them, places like Morocco, for example, or in Egypt. Others are in areas like Syria, Lebanon, where it's not so easy to go into, where the synagogues may, Iraq, where the synagogues may be partially destroyed. How did you go about, you know, kind of adding them to the collection?
So, first of all, even in a place like Morocco, where the sites are, and especially in recent years after we got started, the King of Morocco has done an extraordinary project to preserve 167 cemeteries.
Right.
When we were starting, there were sites that were still just as a reality. You know, the communities have left in many of these places. So, sites that are left behind, it's not necessarily malice. It's just You know, we have a synagogue, Kesser Glen, in the south of Morocco, which is today used as a hay shed. In other places, and especially in the years since we started, there has absolutely been targeting of Jewish sites for destruction. ISIS infamously blew up the Tomb of Yonah in Mosul, and has also targeted Jewish cemeteries throughout North Africa. And other Jewish sites have been attacked. So there was this we always felt this urgency, whether the sites are being targeted or they're just falling into decay, or the people with the memories, the last primary source generation is passing on, we needed to record these histories as quickly as possible. A quick research story for you. So our Indiana Jones, Josh Shamsi, our lead photographer and outreach director, he was in Iraqi Kurdistan and was looking to document sites. And we wanted him to get to this village called Bet Tanur, which means in the oven.
Yeah. Tanur, same word, right?
Yeah, exactly. And we wanted him to get there. And no one was willing to take him. And finally, he was one night after a long day of research, he was invited by the leader of a village nearby, and was at a party, and this old guy with an AK-47 said, you know, these people, don't listen to them. I have a Jeep, I have a gun, I'll take you. So Josh ended up not doing that, but we did get another researcher there. At the time, this area was being bombed by Turkey.
Wow. You know, it's like wartime often are extremely dangerous efforts to preserve synagogues. Have you preserved some synagogues that are in virtual format that are just gone now?
I'm trying to think if we have anything that's completely gone.
I'm sure some that have been seriously damaged.
Yeah, we've identified sites that have been damaged or that have been repurposed. The only synagogue that immediately comes to mind for completely gone is the Elio Hanabi, the Elijah the Prophet synagogue, in the Jobar neighborhood of Damascus, and this was a beautiful even up till, you know, 8-9 years ago, was a beautiful synagogue. The story is that Elijah anointed Elisha, his successor, in the basement. And this was well preserved. And then in the midst of the Syrian civil war, it was raided and caught in the crossfire, and then subsequently completely destroyed.
And yet it exists in Diarna's archive.
Correct. It exists. Virtually, we have the documentation on it as much as possible, and people can still read about the history. And we try to bring as much data as we can to bear: archival photos, contemporary photos, oral history interviews with people who knew the synagogue and know the stories connected to the synagogue, to really make these places accessible and real. Even if, as with Eliyahu Hanabi, it no longer exists.
So tell us what the experience of going to the Diarna website, like how does it all work?
So there's a few different ways to interact with the Diarna website. One is to just look at the map and go explore on your own, and you can drill down into different sites in different places. You can search by the type of site, the country, the year, a number of other criteria. Another way to go is to look at fully fleshed exhibitions. So, for instance, we have the Jews of Star Wars, because we had an expedition to Tunisia a couple years ago with Christy Sherman, another one of our wonderful photographers, and she went to Tatooine, which people will know from the Star Wars movies, but it's actually a really real place. They shot the movie there. And there were Jews at various times in its history, and some beautiful synagogues, which unfortunately still exist in some form, but are one magnificent synagogue is without a roof. And our researchers were able to get into it thanks to the kindness of a businessman across the street who broke the lock, got them in, and then repaired the lock afterwards so that there no one would be the wiser.
That's a great story. What are your favorite parts of the Diarna?
I like some of the sites that are that are highly contentious, but that illustrate our methodology, which is to eschew politics. We're not involved in any of the political issues surrounding Jews in the Middle East and North Africa. The project is under a board of directors, an organization, Digital Heritage Mapping, which is purely dedicated to scholarly research. So, for instance, a site like Haibar, which was the Jewish community in Saudi Arabia, north of Medina, which played a pivotal role in early Islamic history.
Yeah, it's huge, very important, actually, in the Quran, right?
Exactly. So the joke in the organization is if the Saudis ever hire a tour guide, they should probably hire me, because I've tentatively identified the 8 or 9 fortresses, Jewish fortresses, that are mentioned in the Hadith. But like I was saying, we're interested in it from a historical perspective. The site was there. This community existed. But others have politicized the site. There's a chant that Islamists use, Haibar, Haibar, Ya Yehud, Jews remember Haibar. That has been chanted on the Mami Mavara and in New York and elsewhere. Whenever there's protests, Iran has a gun called the Haibar. Hezbollah has rockets called Haibar, because Ali was a hero of the battle at Haibar. So this really illustrates our purpose. You know, we're not engaged in politics. We're engaged in the history of preserving and promoting the Jewish sites in the Middle East and North Africa. We leave contextualization and editorials to other people, but the facts of these communities exist and are unfortunately frequently denied by some who claim, you know, for instance, in Libya or Iraq, that there was no Jewish history in various places.
Tell us a little bit about your own background, would you?
Sure. So as we mentioned before, I have this eclectic background, in the sense that I went to a Catholic university and was the first Jewish class president, and also head of a Muslim organization. I received an award from campus ministry, actually, because of my work at Sacred Heart. But in terms of my family background, there are some apocryphal hints of Sephardic heritage, but otherwise I'm fundamentally and philosophically a Litvak, which leads to more questions about why would a Litvak be interested in Middle Eastern Jewish history. But the reason is that this is our common history, regardless of chance of birth. We all are descended from either directly or again philosophically from the prophet Abraham.
So, in asking you about the American Sephardi Federation, you're the executive director. I'm sure you're the first guy named Guberman to head it. Tell us a little bit about what the American Sephardi organization does.
Sure. So the ASF, which is based at the Center for Jewish History and a partner of that extraordinary institution, is also dedicated to preserving and promoting the history and culture of the Jews from the Middle East and North Africa and what we call the greater Sephardic world. And we do this in several ways. We have publications, which I encourage your readers to sign up for, Sephardi World Weekly, Sephardi Ideas Monthly, the Sephardi Report. We do large academic and scholarly and cultural conferences and programs. We have an Institute of Jewish Experience dedicated to bringing all Jews together and exploring the multifaceted mosaic of Jewish identity. And we're also a member of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, through which we represent the Sephardic voice in diplomatic and Jewish communal affairs. And there's a partnership. Diarna is totally independent. I wear both kippot, as you said, but there's a partnership between them that enables research to be advanced at Diarna and enables the ASF to publish and create physical exhibitions at the Center for Jewish History from Diarna's materials.
In obviously, there's some cross-pollination in all of this, which is, I think, always valuable in organizations, particularly ones that are working in complex areas. The Sephardi world is it's kind of the whole world, isn't it? I mean, it's a very interesting and complicated thing to talk about. The homeland of Sephardi Jewry was the Iberian Peninsula, Spain and Portugal, but in dealing with that, do you cross over into the Eidot HaMizrach? Like, how does that work in terms of making those distinctions into the Eastern Jews of the Orient?
Yeah, so it's a wonderful question, and my board president, David Dangor, has termed this phrase greater Sephardi.
Okay.
And others use Pan Sephardi. But historically and philosophically and for many other reasons, the term should be Sephardi because prior, Edot Mizrach emerged in the 1950s and is used very loosely today. I mean, how can you refer to Moroccans as Mizrahi when they're to the west of Paris and London? And also many of their ancestors, especially the northern Moroccans, come from the Iberian Peninsula. But what we've discovered is that it's very hard to pin down where people came from or their connection to Iberian Peninsula. A recent example, we received a treasure trove of photographs from India and for the ASF National Sephardic Library and Archive. And it was of this woman, Dalia Curiel. Dalia Curiel was born in Turkey. And the Curiels are a very well-known Sephardic family with roots in the Iberian Peninsula. The documentation came from the B'nai Menashe Synagogue in Karachi, Pakistan, where she was married. So you have a classical Sephardi Tahor woman being married in a B'nai Menashe Synagogue, at the other end of the world. And this happens again and again. The Sassoon family had roots in the famous Iraqi family had roots in the Iberian Peninsula. The chief rabbi of...
And by the way, the Sassoon family extended to China.
Yes, yes. So we very much agree with Hakam Jose Faor, who recently passed away, and Hakam Haim Ovadia, and other scholars who have made the case that the term should really be Sephardi, because the rabbis and also the ASF's modern founder, Dr. Daniel Elazar, made the case that the founders of what we think of as Andalusian Jewry were actually, it wasn't a coincidence that many of them were writing in Arabic, that many of them were getting their teachings from the Gaonim of Baghdad, and then remixing and sharing and spreading that tolerant, inclusive, worldly yet cosmopolitan form of Judaism to everywhere they traveled subsequently.
Jason, where can people go to find out about Diarna and to participate in the experience, and also for, of course, the American Sephardi Federation?
So Diarna is diarna.org. That's the best way to experience Diarna for yourself and explore the exhibitions. We have a new exhibit, by the way, a timely exhibit on Azerbaijan. A comprehensive exhibit of Jewish historical sites in Azerbaijan, many of which are now unfortunately under fire due to the conflict between Armenia and
Azerbaijan, right.
Yeah, so you should definitely check that out. And as for ASF, it's AmericanSephardi.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter and other platforms.
Really extraordinary stuff. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Rabbi.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our playout this morning comes from the great Israeli singer Chava Alberstein, the classic Yiddish song Rabbeinu Tam. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Two Jewish will be Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan, my dad, and the 94-year-old author of a new book of Torah commentaries, one for each week of the year. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Wie die goldene Pave flieht über den schwarzen Jan und trocknet mal a Briefele, a rose Liebesbriefele, fahre dem Rabbeinu Tam, fahre dem Rabbeinu Tam, ei, 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 dei, dei, ei, 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 dei, 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 ei, 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 dei, 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 wer hat geschrieben das Briefele, eidel, eidel, dei, geschrieben hat das Briefele, die Malke von der Kai.
geschrieben es mit reuten Tint, unverhasst es geschwind, mit heißen Tränen drei, mit heißen Tränen drei, ja, 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 ja. Wo steht geschrieben in den Briefele, Heidel, Diedel, Du, Rabbeinu Tam, ich liebe dich.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.